It's a beautiful day and a fine time for healing. Podcast host Randy Fine, a narcissistic abuse expert and the author of the groundbreaking book Close Encounters of the Worst Kind and the captivating memoir Cliff Edge Road, invites you into her sanctuary, a place where your physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being are all that matter. So put your feet up, relax, and enjoy today's show. And now, here's Randy.
Good morning. Thank you for tuning in to listen to A Fine Time for Healing. I am your talk show host, Randy Fine. Today's guest, Dr. Mark McLaughlin, is no stranger to fear. A practicing board-certified neurosurgeon, he has helmed countless high-stakes surgeries in which any miscalculation could mean life or death. But decades performing under immense pressure in the operating room led Dr. McLaughlin to a surprising discovery. The secret to success isn't just conquering fear, it's engaging with it more productively. In his new book, Cognitive Dominance, A Brain Surgeon's Quest to Outthink Fear, Dr. McLaughlin shares a new framework for dealing with fear to think and perform at the top of your game during stressful situations. He combines philosophy, psychology, neuroscience, and his own experiences to provide unique insight on how the brain processes fear and how we can change our mindset about this universal condition. Dr. McLaughlin is a neurosurgeon, author, acclaimed keynote speaker, and founder of Princeton Brain and Spine Care. His expert commentary regularly appears in national media outlets such as Business Insider, Entrepreneur, Reader's Digest, MSN, Costco, Thrive Goal. Oh, there's a whole list of them. But anyway, you get the gist of it. He was named a Castle Connolly top doctor for the last 10 years and a New Jersey Monthly Top Doc. Okay. Yeah, that's what it is. I have NJ, so I'm assuming it's New Jersey. Well, anyway, we'll get that straightened out in just a second. Let me introduce you. Good morning, Dr. McLaughlin, and welcome to A Fine Time for Healing.
Hi, Randy. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, it is an absolute pleasure to have you. So your book, when you see the book, it's pretty hard to not see the topic. It's a great big, in great big letters, black letters on a white background, it's written Cognitive Dominance. You say in chapter one, admittedly, this phrase is over-serious and rather intimidating, which are two of the reasons you love this title so much. The phrase cognitive dominance is like wrapping your mind around the Force in Star Wars. It sounds cool, but it's also cryptic and amorphous. So let's start with the technical definition of cognitive dominance. Okay, so I have to agree with you. It is quite a cryptic and strong word. Why don't you tell us what cognitive dominance is in your words?
Well, the definition is enhanced situational awareness that facilitates rapid and accurate decision-making under stressful conditions with limited decision-making time. It's a military term. It was coined by the U.S. Army, and I stumbled upon it about 10 years ago when I was giving some lectures up at West Point for one of their psychology classes. And the moment I heard the term, I was enamored by it, and I just thought, oh gosh, what is this? I need to know more about it. How do I get this? You know, how do I get this? And what factors can enhance learning how to practice this? So I was really excited about it, and that's how it all came about.
So enhanced situational awareness, what is that?
Well, that involves understanding sort of the operating system that your brain is functioning under and understanding that there are multiple layers moving and working at the same time. So what I did was, I thought that with my knowledge of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and my experiences of having, facing thousands of stressful decisions and situations, I thought that I could sort of leverage those two to talk about and really unpack the fear module in our brain, because it's such a universal experience, and it can sometimes, and in some cases, oftentimes, interfere with our best performance. Yet we need a certain amount of it to have a great performance. It's actually a critical ingredient in the spice of great performance. But a little too much, like a little too much salt in a recipe, ruins it. So you want to have just the right amount.
Okay, that makes sense. You also talk about in this chapter, you talk about fear freakout, compromised situational awareness that delays decision making, which increases the severity of the situation. So talk a little bit about fear freakout, and under that it's compromised situational awareness. What are they?
Well, fear freakout is really when your mind's primitive fear reaction system is in place. That's when your amygdala, your primitive lizard brain, is starting to think about survival. And most of the time, survival requires either the fight or flight response, which generally in a modern situation rarely needs to be enacted. So the fear freakout is when we're faced with a complex mental dilemma or a situation at work where we want to just run, or we want to just you know, roll up our sleeves and get into a fight with somebody, either verbally or even physically sometimes. So it's that's the primitive response that we need to recognize and use our neocortex, our higher level executive function, to override in certain situations. But we all feel it sometimes. I mean, it's part of the human condition. And you know, when there really indeed is a life or death situation, that's a very, very helpful survival technique. It's just a rare event in modern times that you need to use that, and it oftentimes is a hindrance towards effective performance.
So, you know, in your profession as a neurosurgeon, it can be a very stressful profession, and you talk about in the prologue, you talk about the first case that you ever experienced as a doctor once you had completed your residency programs, and I found it interesting. Would you explain what that situation was about that patient, the young patient?
Sure. So, you know, neurosurgery residency and training involves, you know, 4 years of medical school, an internship for 1 year, and then 6 or 7 years followed in training, in neurosurgery training. And then I chose to do an additional year of fellowship, which is sort of an in-depth finishing school in a certain subspecialty. And so after I had completed all of that training, you know, I had probably 40,000 hours of training under my belt. And really, in some respects, is at the top of my knowledge game in terms of, like, training, cutting-edge techniques. And so when you go out there, when you're a newly minted neurosurgeon, you have all these, you know, cutting-edge techniques and a strong knowledge base, but you have no experience like I do now, 20 years later. So you take those skills in, and you're certified to practice, and you're licensed to practice, and you have the skills to practice, but it's a lot more stressful for you when you're first starting out, particularly when you're taking, you know, care of very, very dangerous situations. So in the beginning of the book, I talk about how one of my fears was taking care of kids, because I had 4 young kids at the time when I started out. And, you know, I care a lot about my patients. And for some reason, for me, pediatrics just raised a higher level of stakes when I took care of the kids in the pediatric ward. And so when I first met a young boy by the name of Anthony, when he was 8 years old, he presented to me in the emergency room with, you know, he had fallen off the school bus and had a cut on his face. But his parents said, you know, Dr. McLaughlin, there's something wrong with our child. He's sleeping a lot. He's clumsy. He's acting like he's drunk. You know, he works in our restaurant. He helps bus tables, and he's been dropping things. And certainly, you know, there's something wrong. And so in the emergency room, we got a scan, and it showed a brain tumor, a deep-seated brain tumor pressing on the deep area of the brainstem, and he needed a perfect operation. And so that was really the first pediatric brain tumor that I was going to be taking on my own, like after my training. And I had done a lot of pediatrics, but there's a different level when it's yourself taking it on. So that was the setup for it. And, you know, he needed a perfect operation, and I gave it to him. But unfortunately, he began having complications, and that really, really threw me for a loop. It threw him for a loop because he was really having a tough time for a while. But it also affected me because I cared so much about him, and I didn't want to see that happen to him.
And then you went into a depression over this, right?
I did. You know, it was one of those things where I did everything right, and just things went poorly for him. He had a poor pathology diagnosis. He had a number of complications, and I saw this healthy young boy, you know, become neurologically devastated by this terrible disease that had come upon him. And seeing that happen to him, you know, it was foreign to me. I thought, well, I finished my residency, my training, I'm going to be a neurosurgeon now, and life's going to be great. I didn't expect to feel like this. I feel terrible. I felt like I wanted to crawl under a rock after all of the things that Anthony experienced. And somehow I felt that some of it was my fault. Like I could have maybe done a better job, or I could have picked up something earlier and prevented it. When, you know, I felt like I sort of blamed myself. I felt like I let him down, and that caused me to really fall into a depression, and question my skills.
So how did you get back to operating after that? What did you do? What did you tell yourself to give yourself the confidence to get back into operating? Or continue, I should say. Continue operating, because you probably had cases waiting for you.
That's a great question. You got to get right back in there right away. And I think in some respects, I suppressed it. To still function, and I did get back and do surgeries, but it affected me in a way that, you know, that actually I began to, you know, divert pediatric cases away from me, and I ultimately decided I couldn't do pediatric cases because it affected me so profoundly. So that was one thing I did, was I avoided it, but in order to function, I continued to, you know, try and keep it at bay. But it never really left me. In fact, you know, and I talk about this in the book, you know, for 15 years, I carried, you know, Anthony with me in a way that was not healthy. It was feeling like I could have done something more for him. And only until I started writing this book 15 years later that I decided to explore and find out what happened to Anthony. And turns out that Anthony, you know, survived, and he actually is still with his family. And yes, he has neurological deficits and he's got some compromise there, but he's still with his mom and dad, and he's still, you know, the number one guy at the pizza parlor. And when I realized that, I did release my gift, and then I did do what I needed to. I finally got the perspective many, many years later, and I was able to forgive myself. And I let it go, and with that forgiveness came, you know, a healing and a growth. When I realized that, I became a much better doctor, because I realized I did do everything I could, and he had a very tough disease that did some damage to him, but I helped him through it, and I kept him on this earth. So that was that was a reflection later on that I realized.
Wow. That's profound. So you say that you discovered that becoming cognitive dominant is fundamentally simple, but difficult to put into practice. So you broke it into two parts, part one, part two. So what is involved in part one when you're looking at focusing on this fear?
Let's take a step back for a second. Don't think cognitive dominance is something that you ever completely achieve. I think it's sort of a true north that you're trying to follow, that you're trying to, you know, get more perspective on. And so it's something that we can all work on. And some days we find it or we navigate towards it better than others. But I don't know if it's something that you ever totally achieve. I feel more like a student trying to study it and get better at it. So that would be my first, you know, statement about the concept. And again, like you said, it's not this Darth Vader-ish, I want to control you. It's really controlling your lesser self. It's a way of figuring out where your blind spots are and how you can rectify that and how you can, you know, buttress those blind spots and move on and be a better, higher performing person. So I would say part one is recognizing the mechanics of our primitive fear response system, to understand that it was a survival mechanism, and that, as we developed evolutionarily, all the old operating systems are still present in our brain and they're running. And we have to be aware of that so that we know which one is going to best suit the situation. So that would be the first part. And then the second part would be to really understand what evokes fear. And that is typically an unexpected event. So let's start with, like, when do we not have fear? We don't have fear. When we don't have fear, we would call that maybe homeostatic. That's where, you know, we're sort of come see, come saw. Nothing bad happening, nothing good happening. We're not thinking of any worrisome occurrence. Or maybe we actually feel secure or confident. So that's a time when we're not experiencing fear, and that's a great feeling. But then once we start thinking of something or an unexpected event happens on our path from where we are to where we want to be, that's when we start saying, oh, this could be get in the way of what my goal is. What's your goal? You want to go to medical school. Okay, then you get a C on a test. Ooh, that's not consistent with my goal of medical school, right? Or you're at your job and you get a poor performance review. Oh, that's not consistent with my path to becoming the boss. So you experience this unexpected event and it evokes the fear in your mind. But the problem is that the fear is not the solution. It's just the alarm bell. The underlying emotion of fear doesn't solve any problem. What you need to learn is that the fear is it's a signpost for you, and that is something meaningful is up ahead. Something you care about is under attack, and you need to figure it out, unpack it, and make an actionable plan to remedy it. And that's really the key to it.
Okay. And when we're in fear like this, the cortisol gets released, and you say that this can be really dangerous if it continues, if we keep allowing, you know, if this cortisol keeps pouring into our brains, that it can actually, fear can actually kill us. So how would that happen? Like, what is going on with the cortisol in our brain?
Well, it's a hormone that causes us to have, you know, increased sugar in our blood, and it causes us to, you know, it can kill us by, you know, affecting our heart and our vascular system. It can clog blood vessels, which, you know, can lead to stroke and dementia. So it's not something, obviously, if you get terrified in an event, you could have a surge of adrenaline and have a heart attack and drop on the spot. But more likely, it's going to kill you by repetitive insults to your body in terms of damage to your structures, to your heart, to your lungs, to your kidney, to your liver. So it's an unhealthy amount of cortisol that's constantly floating in your veins. So that's what's bad about it if you don't metabolize it properly. And when you metabolize it properly through exercise, sleep, meditation, thinking through fearful events, really leaning into fearful events and unpacking them, that's when we can live a more healthy life. And that's kind of that was kind of the impetus for the book. I had a series of rules that I fall back on in neurosurgery. And those rules are things like never cut what you can't see, never worry about a patient alone, always leave a drain at the end of an operation. Those are things that, you know, keep you out of trouble and save lives. And those rules kind of help you function under the heavy burden and stress of taking care of people's lives.
Okay.
So those are what you lean on.
Okay. As we're talking about fear, I'm thinking about so many of the clients that I work with that are suffering just years of traumatic abuse and are very fearful because it's one of the symptoms of the complex PTSD they're experiencing. So when we're experiencing fear like that, I mean, sometimes I see it in their eyes. It's just that everything is fearful. How do we be rational and unpack that kind of fear, or is that not possible?
I definitely think it's possible. I think you first have to sort out what can I control and what can I not control. There are some things you can't control, like your past actions, like what other people have done to you. That's something that's never going to change. But what can change is your perception and perspective of those events. So that's something you can change. And in my opinion, I think the best way to change it is by getting a different perspective. So, you know, in the book, I talk about how we need to unpack these events with three real questions. What are the objective and subjective valences of this event? Is this a tool or an obstacle on my path from where I am to where I want to be? And then lastly, is this something that I know that's within my knowledge base or system, or is this something that's completely unknown to me? And by answering those questions, you immediately start dialing down the fear bell in your brain, because you're taking an action, and that action and movement, even if it's just mental, it quiets the chatter in your mind. So that's really the system that I propose in my book. So, you know, for example, like if you think of a glass of water. So let's say we have a glass of water and a clear glass. What are the subjective and objective components of that glass of water? Well, objective is like, tell me about the matter that exists there. So that's, you know, there's 500 cc's of water. It has no bacteria in it. It's a temperature of 98.6, and it's contained in a glass flask, right? That we could take that around the world, and every person would describe that essentially exactly the same. So that's the matter of the world. And then you go to the subjective, the what matters in the world. So that is very different based upon who you are and where you live and what your life is and what the stories are in your life. So let's say you and I, a glass of potable water, it's not that meaningful to us. We had some an hour ago, right? We're not thirsty right now. But if you live in a village where potable water is not to be found and you need to walk a mile to get your water, that's a very valuable, meaningful, object in your life. So that's one of the first steps in analyzing an event. Similarly, what are the facts that are, undeniable? And then what do those facts mean to me? That's the first step. And the second step is this a tool or an obstacle? So, you know, if you think about, is this going to propel me towards my goal or not? So think about Rowling and the Harry Potter series, right? So here's a woman who is out of a job, on welfare. I think she had a child at the time she started writing the book, wallowed in sorrow and said, oh my gosh, poor me, what's what's going on here, or she could say, oh, what a great opportunity to start writing a story I've always wanted to write. And sure enough, I mean, out of somebody's objectively negative situation came something subjectively positive, and it ultimately propelled her to her career and to the world benefiting from her objective negativity. So, you know, the interesting thing is in the book I talk about Carl Jung, who was a Swiss psychologist, and Jung studied the alchemists, and we all think of alchemists as crazy scientists that want to turn lead into gold, but he thought of them more as metaphysical scientists, and he thought of alchemy as events in our lives that can be transformative. They can either destroy us or they can create us. And so he believed that the alchemists were really onto something, that there were these unexpected events that came into our life that would give us an opportunity to change the world. And so that's sort of how I would look at that.
Okay. So, yeah, that really clears it up. that really kind of is a very good way, good example of illustrating what you're trying to say, because, yes, fear and, I mean, I always say that, you know, when we have problems in our lives, you know, it usually turns us around and we have the opportunity to do much better, be better, help others, whatever. It's always an impetus for change, and we have the power to either change it for the positive or wallow in our misery. So it's similar to what you're saying. And I understand where fear can be an impetus for us to really kind of light a fire under us and get us moving forward. And I think that's absolutely true. I'm just looking at all my little post-it notes. Okay, so the primal response of fear alerts us to pay attention to it and to use our brain to figure out what it means. And there are two things we can do with the objective fact, and I think that's what you just talked about, right? How to look at that.
Exactly.
How to frame that.
Exactly.
Okay, great. All right.
And so what I do is, you know, I talk about – there's this concept called consilience. Consilience is when you reach into different pockets of science or different intellectual disciplines and you find commonalities between the two disciplines that verify objective things that we see in the world. For instance, Einstein verifying his theory of relativity with both astronomy, physics, and math. So he used three different sciences to prove his theory. So when we can do that, we stand on firmer ground. We really can say, hey, this is solid. So look, another example of consilience is Descartes, who married algebra and geometry and created the Cartesian coordinate system. And I was a big fan of Descartes because I was a philosophy major in college. And that was what provided the impetus to think about how can we map out fear. So what I did was, on the y-axis, I put the subjective component of events, and on the x-axis, I put the objective component, and I began mapping events. And, you know, if you can remember from high school algebra, the Cartesian coordinate system, an x-y coordinate system, gives you four quadrants. There's one quadrant that's positive-positive, and that's when everything's going great in our lives, and we experience this transcendence, and we have no fear. But then sometimes there are some things that occur that maybe are objectively positive but subjectively negative. So like you get a job promotion, but then you realize that the job you got promoted to has a terrible boss and you're miserable. So it's partly good, partly bad. And then there are events in our life that are terrible on both ends, both subjective and objective. Let's say we get a diagnosis of cancer that we've got to deal with, you know. There's nothing objectively good about it, and obviously subjectively it's negative. That's the negative-negative quadrant, what I call is the all-is-lost quadrant. And then sometimes there are events that are subjectively positive but objectively negative. So that's the quadrant where you've got to think your way out. You get dealt something that seems bad, but it actually turns out to be the greatest gift that could possibly be given to you. And then you can move on into the positive again, which is the flow. So of those four quadrants, what I talk about is that the heroic journey of life is to travel through those quadrants. You know, there are a lot of performance enhancement coaches that say, oh, we want to be in flow, we want to be in flow, we want to be in flow. Well, life would be pretty boring if all you did was live in flow. You need to live in the other quadrants as well to learn and to experience the tough parts of life too. It's sort of a yin and a yang. You've got to have it both ways.
That's true. You're right. I like the way you compared that to algebra. That was cool. Do you believe that we possess everything within ourselves to overcome fear, or that there are some things that we, for instance, prayer, meditation, things like that, that we leave it to or call on the support of something else? So do you believe that there are times that we need to call on the support of something else, or do you believe we have it all from within in order to handle these fearful issues?
I don't believe that we have it all from within. I think that, you know, I've always been a believer that the only way you can be great is in partnership with others. And, you know, I think that we, as I said earlier, we all have blind spots. Every human being has strengths and weaknesses. And we can very easily go down the rabbit hole of avoidance or denial when something fearful is coming upon us, and we can behave very poorly. It's just part of the human condition. And the only way to really up the ante on our performance is to get other people's perspectives on things. And so I think that there's obviously a very important component of responsibility of oneself to deal with, you know, an event that's dealt with you. But you also need to reach out to others, get different perspectives, read. I'm a huge proponent of reading. I think reading is the gateway drug of wisdom. And the more you read, the more perspectives you see of other people, the better you're going to be able to deal with this problem and maybe come up with a solution that nobody else ever thought of. That's the beauty of it. But I don't think it's going to come from just within. You need to draw from other resources.
Okay,
we have a rule
in
surgery. One of our rules in surgery is never worry about a patient alone. And that makes sense because there's so many smart people around that you can share that with, and they maybe give you an answer that you didn't think of, a different angle. Very, very important.
Great answer. And I like what you said about reading. I completely agree with you. You know, when people come to me and they say, you know, I know somebody is going through, you know, I recognize that they're going through a narcissistic abuse situation, but they won't listen to me. I always say, give them information to read, because when we read, we download it in our own with our own interpretation from our own perspective. You know, it's really the way that we can solve things. When we tell other people, it doesn't always sink in, but when we read, we absolutely can come to, you know, conclusions, decisions, things like that. So I do absolutely agree with you on that. Throughout
and the
your
science
book,
completely
oh, go ahead.
The science completely backs that up. I mean, they see enlargement of cortical margins when people read. There's science that shows if you read for 9 days, your brain will remain active in those areas of your brain for another 9 days. So it's literally
wow.
like doing exercises on Monday and getting credit for them on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So it's truly there. The science is there. And one other piece of science that's very important is reading a hard copy book is better than reading from a Kindle or from your handheld device. Your level of distraction is lower, concentrate more, and focus is something that we're all losing in this society with all of our different gadgets. Focus is an important part of solving problems.
I love holding a book. I will not read electronic. Sometimes when I, every time I have a guest, I request a copy of their book so that I can read it and familiarize myself. And sometimes people say, here's an electronic version. I don't read electronic versions because I can't sit with it and focus on what I want to focus on. And I can't put little tabs in that. And, and I have hundreds and hundreds of books here. I love my books. I love to hold a book. You talk about the word fear, but it's P-H-E-R-E throughout your book. What is that?
So that's a word that my co-writer and I coined. And basically what it is, we define that as an unexpected event. So our premise is that we do not experience fear unless something gets in the way of our path. And the path is from, and Jordan Peterson talks about this in his book, 12 Rules of Life, and in Maps of Meaning, that the way the world works is, if you're a functional human being on Earth, you're always trying to get to a better place. Why did the chicken cross the road? Well, one would presume the chicken crossed the road because he wanted to, the other side of the road was a better place to be, right? Unless the chicken was, deluded or crazy or not smart. That's why we're doing these things. We all envision to ourselves to be in a better place. So along the way, if we experience an event that is consistent with where we want to go, then we have hope and we have security and we don't have fear. But the second we get an event that doesn't look like it jibes with where we're going, that's when we experience fear. So we said, let's call it something that is, a simple term that makes sense. And Sean picked it and he said, let's call it fear, P-H-E-R-E. And I think it's a great word.
It is. It's like fat, P-H-A-T.
Yes.
I like it. I like it. Chapter 20, you talk about brain 1 and brain 2. Brain 1 being sorting the irrelevant into the relevant, the short-term memory. What did you mean by brain 1 and brain 2? What is the difference?
Brain 1 is that fight or flight, amygdala, lizard brain that's sort of always on guard. It's watching to make sure that you are safe and that there's no threat physically or mentally. And then brain 2.0 is really, that's the part of the brain that's thinking on a higher level of executive function, of, what are the things that I need to do to land this job? What are the things I need to do to strengthen this relationship? And so brain 1.0 is much more selfish compared to brain 2.0. And it's sort of a takeoff of Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is a masterpiece. I highly recommend it. And what he talks about, it's a little bit different. He talks about brain 1.0 being that quick decision mind that can make a gut reaction, as opposed to brain 2.0, which is the logical thought, provoking, decision-making part of our brain. And what he points out is, again, in a life and death situation, brain 1.0 is still top dog and something you want to rely on. But in a complex modern world problem, brain 1.0 often makes the wrong decision. It faces things on emotion, and that's not a good way to run your life. So that's really what I was focusing on with the brain 1.0, brain 2.0.
And I'm trying to figure out where intuition fits in.
Well,
I guess that's more like brain 2.
Part of brain 1.0. No, I think that's the gut. I think that's the gut. And
okay.
You can't count it out. I mean, there are things that your brain will pick up that your neocortex may not. Your more primitive brain. In other words, body language, eye movement, facial expressions when you're talking to somebody. You can pick out whether somebody is engaged with you. You can pick out whether somebody's trustworthy. Those are valuable intuitions. But we have to understand what kind of decision are we making, and where does this fit on our micro and our macro goals.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up.
Sure.
Okay. We had the four quadrants of fear. Do we talk about the four quadrants of fear?
Well, the four quadrants are, again, the flow quadrant is that's the positive.
Okay.
And great.
All right. So
we can do no wrong. Everything that lands in our lap is a tool, and it's a known to us, and you're just functioning great. The calm before the storm is when something we experience is objectively positive but subjectively negative. That's the job promotion with the bad boss. And then the all is lost is when something terrible happens. And then the birthing a new skill set is when it's the opposite, when something objectively is negative but subjectively is positive. So I call that the birthing a new skill set quadrant. And that, for me, in terms of the Anthony experience, was it took me 15 years to get out of the all is lost quadrant and move up to the birthing a new skill set quadrant. When I finally went back and I saw Anthony and I met his parents again and I told them I'm writing this book and I just wanted to tell you how profoundly Anthony affected me, that I stopped doing pediatric neurosurgery and that I moved to New Jersey, and how every time I ever saw his picture, I got sad. And that, his parents came around, they gave me this gigantic hug and they said, "What are you talking about? You're our hero. I mean, you saved our boy." And we keep a picture of you on the wall. We think you saved Anthony. And it took me that experience to realize, oh my God, what a privilege it was to take care of Anthony. Like, how lucky was I to meet him and his family and to care for him. And when I got in that car and I drove home at the end of that day, I couldn't believe how blessed I felt, and also how I stopped holding myself to an impossible standard. And when I realized that, I grew, and I moved back into the flow zone and became a better doctor. So it's really a journey of going through these different processes to become better, a better person, and better at our profession.
Right. Self-inflicted guilt is, what we do to ourselves is far worse than what anyone could ever do to us. We can.
Oh, exactly.
And often, and your situation, I've experienced, often what we fear and what we think other people are thinking or whatever, the outcome of something, generally it's not what we've imagined or not nearly as bad as we've imagined. I write about that. I write about self-inflicted guilt because having been raised with guilt, I know how detrimental that can be to our mental health. So look what you did to yourself all those years. And
I know.
What a shame. But you learned. That's the thing.
I learned, exactly. And I'm
right.
Sharing it. And what's really neat, the first time I told that story, which is a hard story to tell, a police officer came up to me. And he said, I got to share this story with you. He said, about 10 years ago, I got to a house fire before the fire department got there. And I ran in and I busted out six people and I got them all out of the building. And I said to them, "Is anybody else in the house? Is anybody else in the house?" And they said, "No, nobody else is in the house. We're good." And he said, "I was really happy and I felt great." And then the fire department got there and I was high-fiving everybody. And then somebody grabbed me and said, "Wait a minute, we forgot about Grandma on the third floor."
Oh no.
And then he was going to go back in, and it was too late. The house had gotten to the point where he couldn't go in. And he said, "Every time I thought about that, I'm like, how am I celebrating here, saving people, when Grandma's up on the third floor dying?" And as an outsider listening to him, I'm like, oh my gosh, how can you hold yourself to the standard that you should have known that there was another person on the third floor? It's to an outsider, we think, oh my gosh, that's just so illogical. Just let it go. You saved six people. But all he's
right.
thinking about is, I didn't save the seventh person. And
right.
he told me that my story helped him realize that you just can't be perfect all the time. You just do the best you can. You use your training, you rely on it, and you function, and you do the job you're supposed to do, and let the chips fall where they may, and let it go. It's hard to do, though.
That's true.
Easier said than done.
Right. We think we have complete control over what happens in life, and that is not true. That is not true. We can only do the best that we can do, and then we have to let
it
go because there's so many more factors in life, and we don't know what other people's journeys are. We don't know what grandma's journeys are. Maybe that was her time, you know? Maybe that was her time to go, and, you know, we can't really say. We can't take control over it. Near the end of the book, you talk about the IRISE protocol, which is IRISE. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. So that came about when, you know, sometimes when you're in neurosurgery, you have an event that you immediately kind of jump away from. You get scared and you jump away from. And so your initial response is to run away or do something that, you know, is not in the best interest. So what I talk about in the book is I'm using a scope on a patient, and I when I'm using the scope, I experience some bleeding, and I say, you know, this is early on in my residency. My first reaction is to pull the scope out, which is actually the worst thing you could possibly do, because by pulling the scope out, the pathway of the bleeding would not be there, and the bleeding would go into the brain and compress the brain, and it would cause damage. But as long as the scope was in there, the bleeding could come out. So it was really to try and identify, you know, what is the black swan that's in front of me? And immediately, the I is for the identify, and then the R is the reject, and that is reject your first response, because your first response is almost always going to be to protect you. It's your brain 1.0 working. And almost always, that's the wrong thing to do. That's the runaway reaction. So the next step is to inventory what do I have available to remedy this problem. You know, is there anybody else I can again reach to and find out? In a, you know, does anybody have any experience with this? Is this something that we? How do we react to it? And then the next step would be to stabilize. And stabilize means do whatever you need to buy more time, buy a little bit more time so you can think this through. And then lastly, evaluate what the problem is. Just keep picking it apart. Focus in on what it is, not what you're feeling. You know, remember to think laterally. That's another concept I talk about in the book. You know, we're trained to think logically, linearly, step by step. But sometimes you need to think out of the box. What are three other solutions that I haven't thought of? And by getting those other solutions, you may come up with something even more effective, something totally different. You know, an example of lateral thinking is like King Solomon. You know, when the two mothers come to with the baby and they say, King Solomon, this is my baby. No, this is my baby. Will you please decide who's the real mother? And, you know, you'd think that King Solomon would conduct an investigation. Okay, where's the baby live? Who's been taking care of the baby? Who's likely to be baby? And he says, no, we'll just cut the baby in half. And you can each have half. And, of course, the mother's like, no, because he knows the real mother would never allow that to happen. The real mother would say, no, she can have the baby. So
right.
It's that novel approach to solving a problem. If you ever watch House. You know, Hugh Laurie is like a perfect example of a lateral thinker. He dislocates the normal logical thinking of your brain to come up with novel solutions.
That's really cool. I like that. Thank you.
My pleasure.
So I've touched on a lot of aspects of your book. Is there anything else you wanted to share that you think is important for us to know?
Well, you know, I was looking at your bio and your expertise, and I just find it very interesting how, you know, narcissism and how it can affect us, particularly in this day and age of social media, and how it can be so easily fed. And the only other thing I was going to mention was a quote that I keep in my gym. I have a bunch of quotes that I keep on the wall, and I love this Tony Robbins quote. And I think it's part of me writing a book and coaching and what you're doing. You know, you're sharing knowledge with other people. So I love this quote, and I wanted to share it with you.
Okay, great.
Only those who have learned the power of sincere and selfless contribution experience life's deepest joy, true fulfillment. And I just, you know, I love Tony Robbins. I just think he's got, he's helped so many people in so many different ways. And I just find that quote to be so true because, like, when I go to coach wrestling, people would say, like, how could you possibly finish a long neurosurgery day and go to a youth wrestling practice? And to me, that's like my refueling station. You know, that's where
right.
I get energy. I don't lose energy there. You know, when I sit down and write an article and research it and can share some knowledge on a topic, that gives me energy. It doesn't tire me out ever.
Yes, yes. What you were saying about narcissism, you know, it's the work that I do is with people who have been affected by narcissistic personality disorder abuse, which is for those who most of my listeners know because this is what I talk about all the time, but people with narcissistic personality disorder are not the narcissists that we see in this society. They are people that are very much like sociopaths and psychopaths. This is a very, very serious disorder, and they are lacking empathy, and their MO is just abuse and destroy everything they do. Everybody every life they touch is abuse and destruction. So people are very, very broken by the time they either get out of this or the narcissist is done with them. And I happen to be the daughter of a narcissistic mother, so I grew, you know, I lived through the whole process and came out of it, which helps me to really understand what other people go through because it's so bizarre and convoluted that you can't learn this. There's no way to learn this. You have to know it from experience. So I just wanted to say that. So we're talking about your book, Cognitive Dominance. If anybody hasn't gotten that, Cognitive Dominance, A Brain Surgeon's Quest to Outthink Fear. This is a big book, very well thought out. Dr. McLaughlin, where is this book available?
You can get it on Amazon. As in a Kindle version or in a hard copy. And you can also go to Black Irish Entertainment. That's another option. And another thing, if people are more interested in cognitive dominance, is I have a cognitive dominance assessment on my website, markmclaughlinmd.com. And that can give you sort of an evaluation of where you are, and it gives you some feedback on if you wanted to get more of it, where you would get started.
Perfect. I was going to ask you if you had a website. Okay, so it's Mark, and I'm going to spell it. It's MarkMclaughlin. It's just one N. McLaughlin.com. Oh, Mark.
No, it's Mark McLaughlin,
MD.
MD.com.
Yes, I caught myself there. Okay, perfect. So we can go on that and check where we are. This is fascinating stuff. You really put a lot into this book. It's so well thought out.
I had a lot of help.
Yeah?
A lot of help and a lot of thinking, yes. Yeah, I had a great co-writer, Sean Coyne, and I've had a lot of good feedback about it as I worked through it.
That's great. How long did it take you to write the book?
About 4 years.
Wow.
About 4 years. But, I mean, I learned so much, and I read so much. I would never trade that experience. It was wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, I write books as well, and, yes, I learn so much when I'm writing, you know, because you sort of make an outline or you have an idea of where you're going, but then some things you really need to look into and really flesh out more than what you know in your own mind. So I get it. 4 years, that's a long time. That's probably the longest I've ever heard of anybody to tell me. But you stuck with it. That's what's important. Anyway, it
that
has been great.
That is probably my one.
What? That is
you.
Probably
that's
your
one. My one attribute is perseverance, persistence and perseverance.
Okay. Well,
I learned
you
that
have
from my
to be...
youth wrestling coach.
Oh, that's where you got it?
Yes.
Yeah, because I know becoming a doctor you must have perseverance because it is not a short run. It is quite long, and you have to really persevere through a lot of, oh my gosh, I don't even know what to call it, but it's a lot to go through to become a doctor. So it's just marvelous that you got there and that you're doing such beautiful work. Thank you for being my guest today. I am so happy to have had you.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure, and have a great day.
You too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So we are out of time, but if you have any comments or questions about today's show, you can email me at loveyourlife@randyfine.com. May joy and serenity always be yours. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed today's show. Visit randyfine.com, RANDIFINE.com, and be sure to sign up to receive updates on the latest blog posts, events, and upcoming shows. Thank you for listening.
Randy?
Yes. Wait,
oh,
I want to end.
Great. Thank you so
okay,
much.
Okay, I need to end this because this is going to get recorded.
Okay.
But I can call you if you, or you can call me if you want.
On
I'll
the
call
same
you.
Number?
I'll call you.
Okay, call me. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.